views expressed on this program are those of the hosts, guests, and callers, and are not necessarily those of this station, its management, or other advertisers. You're listening to Transformation Talk Radio.
Get ready for a game changer. Sarah Westall is bringing you Business Game Changers Radio. Mondays at noon Pacific, 3 Eastern, Sarah will bring you leading experts, visionaries, and newsmakers who provide the best commentary on big issues and cutting-edge innovations. Sarah's 20 years as a business executive will help you think like an entrepreneur with expertise, energy, and attitude. Now here's your host, Sarah Westall.
Welcome to Business Game Changers. I'm Sarah Westall, and you're listening to the Conscious Business Radio Network on Transformation Talk Radio. Today's episode, we are going to be talking about disruption, innovation, and the extreme changes that are going on in business. And I have a guest, Richard Lindemuth, who is the co-founder of Virto Partners. And this firm consists of senior advisors and interim executives who are literally the who's who of CEO leadership from around the country. I mean, he has people that helped Lee Iacocca bring Chrysler around. And he actually brought, he was a CEO of ITT, Business and Consumer Communications Group, where he led 20,000 people through our employees through a rapid deregulation, and he quadrupled the revenues. But we're going to talk about this business climate and how companies are in situations where they need to change focus, they need to change their strategy, and how he goes about doing that, and how he helps companies turn around and do the change management inside of companies. But before we get into that, we're going to talk about fraud. If you haven't noticed, there is an epidemic raging across this country in every levels of business and in government with fraud. And in fact, a recent study conducted by the Association of Certified Fraud Examiners found that a typical organization loses 5% of their revenues each year to fraud. The medium loss that they found was $145,000, with the smaller organizations losing even more as a percentage just because of the more risks that they have in their business. So I'm going to bring on expert Jason Chez, who is the founder of Chez Compliance and Advocacy Group. And he's going to give us advice on how to combat fraud and to avoid these hardships and tragedies and the scams that cause businesses and government and society at large to struggle. So now we're going to welcome Jason Chez to the program.
Hi, Jason. Welcome to the program.
Hi, good to be with you.
So there are daunting statistics out there based on what I just got done reviewing. What can businesses do to keep from being a victim of this fraud?
They have to take the issue of fraud seriously. They have to make sure their compliance department or HR department or the owner, if it's a smaller company, educates the employees on the seriousness and the consequences of white-collar crime and fraud, kickbacks in particular.
Well, how do you get employees to follow this? I mean, especially if some of them are part of the scam.
Well, that's exactly why companies hire my corporation. We come in, and when I speak with them, it's not it's in addition to the compliance department and to their current training. And it adds another level of education where they see that it can happen to them, and they see the consequences and what the experiences that I've had, and actually instills a little bit of fear into them and makes them think twice before doing it.
Well, how do you do that? Do you have a conversation? Do you do a talk? Do you work side by side? What do you do to instill fear and get them to understand?
We have a conversation. I do a talk and then answer questions, and it always ends up into a longer conversation that, you know, people start feeling comfortable and ask questions. They then realize something that they might be doing or that a vendor might have offered, it, you know, constitutes a kickback. And that's one of the big questions is, what is a kickback? You know, what constitutes it? What doesn't? Is dinner? Is a Christmas gift? That kind of thing.
Well, yeah, because that seems like it's just part of business, right? I mean, you just...
Right, and when it starts... Well, first of all, it could be against your company's policies, but when it gets to the point of interfering with normal business practices, such as increasing the amount of an order for things that you don't need because someone's giving you a piece of it or someone's getting you extra gifts, that's a kickback.
Oh, so it's when it's a little bit over the top kind of stuff.
Exactly. I mean, if they take you out for dinner, that's not going to get you in trouble. This usually goes on, you know, it starts out small and it always gets bigger and people always get caught. People plan on having it small the whole time and greed kicks in and the vendor's greed kicks in and people start taking more and more money and more risks. And they see that they've gotten away with it so far. So, they end up shooting themselves in the foot.
Well, give me a specific scam that businesses suffer often that you can help them or give us some tips that they can do to avoid those kinds of things.
Well, surprisingly, kickbacks are a big one. And surprisingly, a lot of our customers, what we noticed, speaking with the employees that deal with vendors, are that the vendors will start off with normal gifts and they'll put the feelers out there. Are you allowed to get a Christmas gift, et cetera? And when they bring up the conversation of kickback with them, they tell them that it's legal because they say that they'll form a separate corporation and, you know, there's no way of getting caught. It's not really a kickback because they're a partner in the business. And that seems to be a trend that I was surprised to hear that so many of the vendors that are approaching the employees have the same scam in their head.
And a lot of owners and business executives don't even realize this is going on, do they? Because they just are presented like this vendor does a great job and whatever, and you don't really get to see behind what's really going
on. Exactly.
So are there any red flags? Is there any red flags that somebody can look for?
Sure. The biggest red flag is normally you'll be dealing with someone for a while before this kind of a thing starts. And if you see an increase in sales to this customer, you follow the money and you see if there's irregularities where all of a sudden you're stocking too much of this or you're using this vendor for, 50% of your business when before it was 5%. Something to look at.
Some swings. So who do you...
The other thing that...
Yeah.
Oh, sorry.
No, go
the
ahead.
The other thing that we find interesting is not just the greed, but the level of arrogance in the people that are committing this, meaning the employees. Let's say you have an employee that's making $50,000 a year and they start getting kickbacks. And let's say it's a larger corporation where a larger amount of money could be missing or hidden without people noticing. They'll pull up in a $75,000 car and they'll buy a fancy watch. And all the employees are the ones that notice. And ironically, the employees are usually the ones that will do the whistleblowing. Because out of jealousy more than anything.
Sure, they don't like it. They don't like that. So who do you work with most?
We work with hospitals and corporations, both small and large. So when my particular expertise is with hospitals, and we work with everyone from national hospitals that are all across the country to just the local ones with the purchasing departments and compliance departments. As well as large corporations from Fortune 500 companies down to mom-and-pop shops that have several employees that they allow to work with vendors, that can get in trouble and they want to keep them out of it.
So with so much of the revenues that the average company loses, so, like 5% of the revenues to fraud each year, you more than give them the ROI. I mean, their investment in something like you is huge.
For sure, but it's not even the money. It's not the money. It's the lives and businesses that are ruined. If you get in trouble for this, it's all the employees that are out of a job because usually the vendor will be shut down.
Oh yeah, it's bigger than that.
Let's say the vendor was Right. Let's say the vendor is the owner operator, and they're the one that's negotiating with you with kickbacks. They're going to shut their business down, and it just becomes a much bigger deal. I mean, the money really isn't the big concern, besides the fact that most people are covered by their insurance for fraud.
Oh, that makes sense. Well, how can people get a hold of you if this is something that they would like to do for their own companies?
Sure. They could call me at 847-346-9964, or they could email me at jason@chezcompliancegroup.com.
Okay, great. Thank you so much for joining us today and giving us information on this really important issue for people.
Sure, anytime. Thanks.
Okay, thanks, Jason.
Jason is amazing. He has an incredible personal story that I'm going to have him back to share it. And he's going to be back periodically just to talk about fraud and how we can prevent it. I think it'll help a lot of people in this country, but his own personal story is absolutely amazing. And I brought him on just as an expert and realized what his personal story was. So we're going to bring him back and he's going to share that with us at a later date. But now we are going to move on to Richard Lindemuth and learn about how to turn around companies and really excel. So now let's welcome Richard Lindemuth to the program.
Hi, Richard. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Sarah. Thank you for inviting me.
You've written books, or you wrote a book recently, The Outside the Box Executive. Why did you name that book that title?
Well, you know, we all live in boxes at different times in our lives, whether it's as a parent, a child, in school, or whatever else. And, you know, they serve their purposes for setting standards. But in real time, in the real life, and particularly in the economy of today, boxes don't work. In fact, you know, it's been said, what got you here will not get you there. So you can't be in a box. And we need to have the technologies are changing. The internet's been added. Company markets go up and down. The dot-com bust. I mean, you can't do things the same way they've always been done. And so outside the box is very important.
And the struggle is understanding and being aware and conscious that you're actually in a box, right?
Yeah. Sometimes you don't even realize it. All of us fall into those kinds of traps. But when a company or a group or however comes in and wants some new thoughts and new leadership, You're trying to break that box. Now, attacking it with explosive or something is not a positive way to do it either.
Well, that's disruption, right? It's
right.
Disrupting, and it's well, that's what new technology does do, because people are in their boxes and they're not ready for it versus embracing it because you're ready for it. But you call yourself also the extreme CEO. What does that mean?
Well, you know, an extreme CEO, I look at it as the condensed version. McKinsey did a study a long while ago and said basically 28% of the people they studied said the quality of strategic decisions in their companies were good. 60% thought bad decisions were as frequent as good, and 12% thought good decisions were infrequent. Well, we can't provide that kind of leadership. We have to be pretty much
where you just flip a coin and it could be bad or good.
Exactly. I mean, it's not a question. And, you know, the inside a company, their history of resources that have made the company into what it is today. People know, you know, the answers are right there in front of you. And so if you listen and you are at all analytic and you communicate well and you're able to accept other people's ideas, but then at the final call, it's your decision. You don't have to, you know, come in and waste time or decide, you know, banging your shoe on the table a la Khrushchev or something like that and saying, this is what we're going to do. Nah, you know, you listen. The answers are largely there.
Well, if you do that, then people shut down and then you can't tap into the intelligence and the ideas of others. And you're only one. But if you can tap into so many other people, you can really rise the ship a lot faster. Right?
It's their ship. And once they figure out that you're trying to help, and you know, as a CEO, you do have the resources, you are able to set the priorities and what have you. So once the people have basically shared their thoughts and have learned that, you know, you're very open for that. I call it active listening. Basically, in my book, I state that you repeat back what you think you heard in your words to affirm that you're on the same page. Pretty soon you find out that a lot of the people are thinking that way. They saw the inventory build up. They saw the machines not working on the factory floor. They saw the shipments not going out the door and what have you. And they all have their understanding of what those the reasons are. Once they share those and we have a good collaboration, good teamwork, and some analytics that go along with it, and you start making, and in the beginning, they're not major strategic decisions. Just fix the machine.
Well, people aren't idiots, right? They're seeing this stuff sitting there.
Yeah, and this is their career. This is their company. They really have a pretty good idea of where the things are. They may not know the priorities. They may not see the total picture, but they are vested. And let me tell you, once they understand that you're taking their ideas and putting them in priorities and putting resources behind them and making them work, it's their solution. It's their company. You can see the light bulbs go on around the tables, and it gets exciting. That's fun.
Well, ownership is a big difference. It's a big motivator, isn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, I can go in and tell people what to do and be somewhat right. But once they tell me what to do and they have a good group, it doesn't matter if it's perfect. If you're moving in a positive direction, good leadership can modify that direction slightly as you go forward to get a little bit tighter focus.
Well, you have had some impressive assignments in your past, one being the CEO of ITT, which is a pretty large corporation. Now, it went through deregulation in the early 80s with AT&T and all the other telecom systems. Now, why did ITT have to go through that whole deregulation process?
Well, in 1984, it was regulated,
the regulation process. They went from not being regulated to being regulated.
Well, they basically were subject to AT&T and to the legislation that came back for deregulation, because they were the manufacturer of the systems, of the hardware, of the telephones. At that point, I recall someone telling me that I couldn't invent a new telephone like a cordless phone and things like that, because telephones had to be dropped from 19 feet and not break.
Yeah, that's crazy. The world has changed so much. But once that whole industry got broken up, it allowed for evolution, for innovation, and for other companies and other people to take ownership and to create a lot of products. So how did you manage through that? And did you see what was about ready to come? Did you see what we have now today?
But I tell you what, I am aware, and I can give you a quick update of today. But, back in those days, we were, I'll give you an example. We had the ability to retail telephones. And I took out an advertisement with 28 million coupons in Best Food Day, I believe on Wednesdays across the United States. And I had one of the senior executives give me a call, from New York, saying, "Oh, Richard, you just don't understand the telecom industry. This is not like hamburgers. You don't put coupons out and sell telephones." Well, the very next day, there were a number of articles in newspapers across the United States about how ITT Telecom had pulled a coup, and that AT&T was going to follow the very next Food Day week with coupons, etc. So all of a sudden I got a call back saying, we were wrong. Again, that's back inside the box. That's the way they had always done it.
Well, telecom, I came from telecom in my early days, and talk about being in the box.
Oh my gosh.
Yes. So, and then the whole industry exploded, right? They pretty much got blown up.
Yeah, no, I did say I'd comment on today, because it's a very huge issue of today. In 1984, the belief was the breakup of the telecom industry would cause a lot of competition. It would lower prices, increase productivity, et cetera, et cetera. And it did somewhat. However, the old Bell companies, the Southwest Bell, the Cincinnati Bell, the and the AT&T company, basically found that they could not charge outside of their region. So Southwest Bell, based in Atlanta, had a region or Southeast Southern Bell, and Cincinnati Bell and others had sort of regions, so that the people who could charge nationally could actually lower prices. And what happened was the industry consolidated. They bought each other. Southwest Bell bought AT&T.
Yeah.
And so prices did not go down. Some of the competition that we expected was not there. And today, our biggest issue is that high-speed broadband, for example, is the same as telecom back in the 40s, where I had an uncle lived in a farm that he used to have to drive to town to make a long-distance call. Well, today, the pipes that need to be there for high-speed broadband, we're talking 5 to 10 gigs, are the same as that, and they are basically pipes. They are not anything else.
Do you think there isn't an incentive to get the high-speed, the fiber to everybody's curb, essentially? Is it just there isn't the incentive to do that?
At the moment, there's not the individual incentives. And one of the telecom executives told me not too long ago that if they move too quickly, because the American public is not that knowledgeable and not moving that quickly,
sure,
that they would actually lose revenues and lose profitability.
That makes sense. You got to go at the speed that the society can absorb the technology. Now, every industry, I shouldn't say every industry, but lots of industries are struggling with the same concept. Because of technology.
Are doing it.
Countries are struggling with this.
In Korea, you can get 10 gigs for $20 a month. In France and in Europe, they've already started improving it, but they have government-controlled PTTs. So, or PTTs, rather. So, but if we're not connected, then we're not going to be competitive.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, so we have this technology challenge, but if you go into another industry, whether it's medicine or whether it's energy or, you know, there's all sorts of different industries, software, where the same concepts apply because the ability for people to absorb the new technology is not as quick as we are able to generate new technology.
Yes, and there's not, it's a very interesting problem, Sarah. And it relates back to the interim execs and what I did. There's no template out there anymore. When, you know, the World War II stopped and the executives came back from the military, the CEO was basically the captain and everybody reported to the CEO and nobody questioned the CEO's judgment. And, you know, for people like my mother, I was supposed to join a company, stay for 30 years, get a gold watch and,
exactly.
And retire. Okay, that template was there for years. Eventually, we had so much hubris that we said, for example, quality circles and a lot of the innovations in constant improvement, manufacturing and what have you, Six Sigma and what have you, were done. But we didn't imbibe. We basically shipped them over to Japan. They did it. They put quality circles together, and eventually they became the number one manufacturing country in the world. So all of a sudden, it set back the United States. Well, all of those things have been breaking down for a number of years. And now technology changing so quickly, the Internet of Things, the advanced digital connectivity, the high-speed broadband, and robotics.
Yeah.
And robotics. And the machines inside the factories now talk to one another, tell you how much inventory you have already used, tell how much preventive maintenance they might need, if they have to go down or not. You can electronically compare the productivity of one factory in, let's say, GlaxoSmithKline to another one in GlaxoSmithKline, and they can tell where their productivities are going up or down and why. This is all new.
The other thing is, you know, 3D printing is about to disrupt distribution on a scale that we haven't seen.
Yes.
It's pretty incredible. So as an interim executive, because I know you personally do that, but you also have a company that has a collection of interim executives. How do you find people that can think out of the box like that? Because that's a hard skill set to find.
It is, but it is learnable. I mean, in fact, I had a a wonderful lady who was a marketing manager in a company that I took over a few years ago. And she basically, I mean, really took responsibility for a lot of the actions, understood what was going on. And she was one of the people first that suggested I write a book. And second, she's now CEO of another company that is doing extremely well because of the innovations she's brought to that company. So it is learnable, and it just is, don't accept things as they are.
Don't accept things how they are and have an open mind, but yet still listen to people. And it's an interesting skill set. So what reason would a company want to bring in an interim executive? Because I can see a lot of reasons, but what are you seeing out there?
Well, I mean, in the basic, I would say corporate improvement. Every corporation out there can improve, but cutting the advertising budget or just, you know, getting the short-term profitability up is not corporate improvement. And a lot of times people are facing market, manufacturing, technology, other changes. In today's market, as you pointed out, Sarah, it's often that they're facing all of those changes at the same time. High growth creates its own problems.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
You can outgrow your computer systems and everything else, or you can put an ERP system in that is way too big and complex, and even acquisitions. There was a Bain study that basically said 60% of acquisitions fail and within the first 2 years, and that the CEO generally leaves. I kind of like to use the anecdote.
Well, it's cultural problems.
It's a cultural problem. But CEOs are not used to getting the millions of dollars of synergies that the investment bankers and the board say are available for
an acquisition. Oh, absolutely. Yeah, they need to get a little bit more to reality. And I don't think people realize the cultural clashes and how that holds people back. But, you know, a great CEO can manage that change. And that's what you see an interim executive do. Now, do they usually stay for a short period of time and then use their talent somewhere else?
Sometimes I've come in as a shadow for something like the acquisition. I mean, I use the story of an old mountain man saying to his buddy, you get the bear and I'll cook it. And you see the guy running through the snow with a bear chasing him behind. He runs into the cabin, dives out the window and yells, cook it. That's kind of the way a CEO feels when he has to get these synergies from this acquisition. Well, sometimes as a shadow, I can go in, or an interim CEO can go in reporting to the board so that we're not reporting to the guy that's already there and causing him more problems.
Well, and they might be threatened a little bit, right?
They would be. But it's pretty easy for senior guys to figure out that they're not stepping on each other's turf and stuff. And that
they get it as long as it's transparent and they understand why you're there, right?
Exactly.
Has to be transparent, because otherwise, if you can't get them to work with you, it could be a mess.
Yeah, no, you don't. Politics and stuff like that are avoidable. They start at the top, and if you don't start them at the top, then they don't get supported. So it's a lot easier for someone else to come in who's done things like this before, build a team in the company that's being acquired, build a separate team in the one that's doing the acquisition, and ask both teams to decide why they think this acquisition is important, what they think they can get in terms of synergies. And then what I do is I build a bridge team of the people who are most successful in those, because the answers are the same. And then you build a bridge team with the people who have basically agreed, so that it's not, well, let's fire everybody in the acquiring.
Which is awful. They do that a lot. Companies.
Oh, sure.
Which then makes it more likely for it to fail.
Absolutely. And I mean, and it's human nature. I'm not going to fire Jim. He's been here for 20 years. In fact, I've gone into companies where we haven't really had to fire. We've done consolidation of sales forces, engineering forces, new thrusts in areas where it needed some revitalization and things like that, or spun off companies as opposed to just laying off people.
Well, if it has value, it has assets, it has income coming in, it doesn't necessarily make sense to just kill it, right? I mean, worst case, you can spin it off and sell it.
Exactly. And you look at, you know, where are the core businesses? Where are there overlaps? Where are there integrations? Where are the, you know, the energy levels that are not in this company? And it's complex in its description, but it really comes down to people, motivation, and focus. That's really what the extreme CEO or interim CEO does.
Well, do you see boards and conglomerates treating CEOs and essentially the C-suite executives like other positions that can be hired on a temporary basis?
I don't see it very much in the United States. This is a phenomenon that grew up in Holland and England and Germany, largely because of the very strict rules in terms of employment, and it became a facilitation, and they've taken it down to the analyst level. But it is happening. What I do see is that, for example, people will say, well, you know, how much domain experience do you have? And in reality, well, you don't bring domain experience. You bring problem solving and other experiences. I'm not going into a toaster company to teach them how to make toasters.
Exactly.
So that part of it is not understood. That box is still out there very strongly in the United States. It's slowly, when people come in and really make a difference, it's slowly being broken down. But so many times, a CEO leaves for whatever reason. And I always say that two easiest people to fire in a company are the CEO and a janitor. They just, whatever reason, it may not be very well held, but they can just get rid of the guy or girl.
Well, in that case, it is, if they can get rid of them so easily, we don't realize how temporary they really are in our mindset.
Exactly. Know? Exactly. And then what they do is they'll put somebody else in charge, like the CFO or whoever else. But the CFO is protecting his job. He's not going to make any serious strategic decisions along the way.
Well, especially if that's how they're treating the CEO. So everybody starts, if the board treats the CEO like they're disposable, then everybody looks at their position like it could be disposable. So they
exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And when I always tell the vice presidents of the company that they are the elder counsel. They have reached their positions through expertise, through hard work, good judgment, but they have reached a point in their careers where they do not like to have their judgment questioned. So I'm not going to question their judgment. I'm going to go down and listen to the people who are out there doing the work every day, who see the inventory building up, who see the investments in product lines being focused only in one area. Well, I'm going to talk to those people. Now, I'm going to bring back that information and have those people, individuals, present their thoughts and what have you to the elder council, because they did get there through good judgment and what have you. And I'll tell you what, the first one or two times that happens and the fear goes away and people say, oh, man, okay, I can understand how this works. And teamwork and collaboration come together fast, and that makes a heck of a difference.
Well, because they're smart, right? So if you present them with stuff and they see it, they're going to be like, oh, okay.
Right. I mean, I've never heard of anybody that, A, was hired because they weren't smart, or B, went to work every day thinking, I'm really going to mess this company up.
Well, how can an interim CEO affect the bottom line in ways that the traditional hire cannot? There really is a difference in the way a CEO comes in the interim can make a difference.
Well, there are several things. First, if you are hired into a company that is running fine and has been doing so for years, I mean, the administrative assistant probably knows the numbers and everything as well as anybody else and could run the company in a short period of time. If you're going into a company that's broken and needs to really get fixed, that's usually the traditional guy. That's where the boxes are. You know, you go into a company and they say, we tried that and it doesn't work. Well, okay.
They tried it, but maybe not with this element with it.
But if you go into a company with a clean sheet of paper, you know, a brand startup or something like that, if you try to impose all of the heavy accounting that you learned in a big company or what have you, that's not going to work either. So you need to have a different thought process for a startup or for new initiatives, even within large companies. And then the worst, obviously, is a company that has all of the above. It has problems. It's outgrown its IT systems. Its market has changed. Management is absolutely confused and fearful. So none of those really fit the traditional guy who's been, or girl who's been running things, doing well. In most of it, we have deep knowledges of how the pieces of an organization fit together to create value and deliver results. Because it's looking at the seams of the handoff between the engineering and manufacturing, or sales and marketing, or R&D and the new product development process, or whatever. Look, focusing on strengthening an organization seems to maximize really good coordination, get rid of fragmentation, get rid of the old ways of doing things that are traditional or respected rather than really good. The other is we don't have the legacy. We don't have the this is the way it's always been done. So we can engage others' ideas, analyze data for insights, weigh alternatives. We got to own the final call, and we got to communicate clearly. But the answers are right there in front of you. And if not completely, then there are some ways to get some guidance quickly from outside that is not disruptive either.
Well, interim CEOs have often conjured up distrust, you know, with like the famous example of Al Dunlap. They called him the hatchet man with his notorious Sunbeam adventure. How do you see yourself and your colleagues differing from him?
Well, I've got a partner, Harry Gray, who said basically a chainsaw Al is what we used to call him. We don't believe in cutting costs to mediocrity. That's just not.
He's like a blind cutter. He goes in with the chainsaw blindly.
Yeah. And so who the heck hired somebody to do that because they were so I'm sure he didn't have a track record of cutting things to mediocrity that somebody pointed to and said, that's what we want.
Because I think it's such a cruel way of doing it and such an ignorant way of doing it. Talk about destroying a culture overnight.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, and we have a lot of rules that we pride ourselves in. In fact, the last company or the company I'm in charge of right now, Styrotech, we actually added people while they were losing money because they needed some key basic strengths in some areas. But, you know, we have some basic things that we stick very solidly to. And that is, like, I was in a company where we did have to do some layoffs. First, we do them quickly, solidly, and we don't do one this week and then say, oh, we should have done more or something like that. We think them through, get them done quickly.
Consciously.
The second part, yeah, consciously. And we get other people's involvement. And the other part we do is that we understand that there are people, and we use the example of, let's say, a mother who has several children who's working two jobs to keep things straight in this economy. She's untouchable, you know, period. There's no reason to do
especially if she's a good employee. Now, if she's really struggling, then maybe you look at it and say, okay, how do we help her? But agreed. I mean, somebody's just doing whatever they can to do their responsibilities. And if we just cut people at the knees, people like that, what kind of people are we?
Exactly. I mean, you can do so much social damage without thinking to be a chainsaw owl kind of guy. I mean, that's not, that doesn't help anybody. Doesn't help the community. Doesn't help the company. It certainly doesn't make people trust you after you've done things like that. So we try to get A, it done very quickly so that it's only done once. B, look, and, you know, you can fire a lot of people at the bottom and not do very much at all. You can pick people. You know, I usually ask people, give me the top 10 people in your company. Tell me why they're the best in your department and what they've done recently. And please don't list your brother-in-law or sister-in-law as your number ones.
Well, yeah.
So, you know. You do have those kinds of conversations.
Well, but what do you say about the executives that come in and they are looking to, you know, spin off companies, do mergers, and they're really investment firms that just are looking to make $100 million off that company and run. And you've seen that.
Yeah, we all see it. I mean, it's even exacerbated today because nobody's sure. The boards are no longer sure about the templates that we talked about of traditional ways companies look. And so many core businesses have grown up and not sold off some of the businesses that they should have a long time ago. I'll give you, I was an electronic connector company. It was about to be delisted from the stock exchange. We basically cleaned it up, got everything going. And as I got a chance to look at things, we had 10,000 products. But we also had some of the original products, which were bass lures that were made by the founders of the company before this company went public. Well, the company wasn't in the bass lure business, but they were still manufacturing them and not making any money. So you didn't need that. We spun that off pretty quickly for
But see, that's smart spinoffs and things. And you could make money by spinning off portions of the companies and making a reasonable profit. But what do you think? How do we go about keeping it where we're spinning off companies, taking $100 million or taking a big chunk of money to the point where that takes down the company itself, but yet we're wealthier for it?
Well, you know, I'll tell you what, in every single instance, this is my 23rd company, Sarah. In every single instance, the very least that we've returned on people's investment in terms of our salaries or our payments has been 10 to 12 times. The most that I have recorded has been 70 times our expenses.
So basically, if the board is conscious of what they're doing and the board is paying attention to the needs of the people that they're serving, which are their investors and shareholders, but also the employees of the company, then they will make sure that when they bring in executives such as yourself, that the ROI is in the best interest of the people they serve. And it's really the board's responsibility. Although you go in with the expectation that the board is going to have that expectation.
Yes, although it's a fundamental precept in our business that the board is not there in the day-to-day operations. So their notion about what the problems really are may not, and in fact, most often is not accurate. They may be directionally correct, but they are at a, you know, a 10,000 foot level, as it were. They're not boots on the ground every day, seeing and listening to the people who are working the jobs and know exactly what's going on.
So is the board easy to manipulate since they don't know what's going on a day-to-day basis? If they bring in an outside firm that convinces them that this is what you need to do, they could easily be taken by somebody like that. So the board needs to be a little bit more aware.
They should be. And easy to manipulate, but most boards.
But you know what I'm saying, cuz you hear about that. Well, Mitt Romney, when he was running, there was ads about him doing that with his company. I know he did a lot of good things too, but there's so many companies, a lot of the Wall Street, executives, well, they'll raise money for companies and they'll take $200 million when they raise, you know, $500 million. And that $200 million would have went a long way to helping that company prosper. You know, they could have taken $50 million. That was way more enough for what they were doing.
And, right. And what we look at is if we're going to save $100, We want basically 2 to 5. You know, you keep the 95% of the things we brought back to the table here. I mean, so keep it reasonable. And we try to set some baselines as we go forward, an assessment of what really needs to be done, how long it needs to be done, what can be done quickly. And that assessment is not something that can be done in 1 or 2 days. So basically we say a 45 to 60 day assessment if we can. Sometimes if it's really in trouble, believe me, we go in right now and start taking actions. But, you know, that assessment then acts as a board tool for why things are going. How do you have some milestones and measurements that are positive? So the board is allowed to participate and provide their guidance as well and their thoughts, rather than just have somebody come in like a chainsaw and get you back to mediocrity.
Well, but I think it's so important to bring in an executive team like yourself or an executive that has those goals in mind, you know, that these are the goals of what we're trying to achieve. And they're bigger than, you know, we all want. The bottom line is important, but the bottom line within this structure of goals, which is, go ahead.
Absolutely. It is. I mean, and it's critical that people understand that there are no magic formulas. Every company is different, but there are things that are there. There's one thing I call strategic empathy, and that's basically listening to people and putting yourself a little bit in their positions. None of us with a CEO personality like to hear somebody say no, but you better be able to allow it and put your own ego and stuff in the background while you go through some of these analyses and discussions and what have you. You know, because a no can mean a bunch of other things. It can mean I'm fearful. It can mean everything else. So no is important, but strategic empathy, putting yourself in other people's places, understanding that they're fearful that they will be blamed if they say something that everybody knows and all these other things. It's critical, and that communication then needs to go upward to the board as well. And very often I have people say, I tell you this, but please don't tell anybody else.
Well, I'm sure. Yeah, that probably happens a lot.
It does. But, you know, what I try to do is I don't tell anybody else until the suggestions are successful. And then the success is that person's success as well. It's not my success as a CEO. No, I that person came forward, provided some things. I provided the resources, and that team did it. I had a time when there were $50 million worth of no moving inventory. And I asked a whole bunch of people what different solutions they might have. The accounting team came up with discounting it, selling it through the same sources. Two young MBAs just out of school came back and said, you know, that was the channel that made it in not moving in the first place. What we think is that we could find somebody like Big Lots and that we could probably sell the entire inventory to them at a discount and one clear program. And my comment was, great. The first half of that inventory is mine. The second half of the inventory, you guys can split. And let me tell you, they had a nice paycheck for two young MBAs that were only a couple years out of school. And we got rid of all of that $50 million, and we actually were cash positive in our resolution of that issue.
Good for them. Yeah, it's listening to different kinds of people. Well, you founded Virtual Partners, right? I'm pronouncing that right?
Yes.
And you have an impressive collection of executives on staff. First of all, who are some of the people you have on staff, and what are some of the highlights that you've done for companies?
We really got a nice small team of guys. Don Bibeau is one of the founders. He acted as the restructuring officer for Chrysler with Lee Iacocca. So we've done big things. We've done lots and lots of companies. We've done the public company that I mentioned where they were going to be delisted from the stock exchange. The stock went down to 75 cents. We, in a relatively short period of time, brought that company back up to $5 in the stock market. We have across industries, agriculture, healthcare, lumber.
Kind of the who's who of companies and an A list of executives. I mean, it's really impressive.
So that's fun.
So, yeah, well, yeah, when you get around, surrounded around people like that. So how can your group of experienced leaders, okay, you guys are the A team of leadership here coming in, helping different companies. How do you see you helping the country move forward in our shaky economy and all the weird things going on right now with, you know, politics and the economy and Wall Street? And we have fraud at levels that are incredible. And I mean, how do we fix this? How can we use people like you who have the talent and the, you know, the experience that can go in and get things done?
Well, you know, I think, first off, let me make a comment. In 2008, Mr. Buffett actually put $8 million back in the economy through Goldman Sachs and in other ways, because he felt that if people saw a respected investor going back and buying stocks and doing things, that it would have a very positive impact. So, there are people like Warren Buffett who believe in America and who try to do the right things. It is very hard to pick the perfect things to do those actions with. But it would be nice to get people who understood that, you know, everything from healthcare does not get fixed by the top. The president does not go into a company and suggest that this is what we're going to do. He listens. So listening is an important part of it. The other part of it is some truthfulness. I mean, what is driving our economy right now is basically the sale of automobiles. And yet the creditworthiness of the new purchasers of automobiles is a little bit like the mortgage issues that got us in problems in 2008.
Aren't they doing the whole putting them together and reselling them, repackaging them.
Yes.
Yeah. So yes. All that stuff is going on just like before.
Well, it's a little bit worse than before in the sense that, I'll give you one example that the banks would absolutely agree with. The banks today are not lending money to any lender or any borrower that has not got plenty of collateral. And in the past, if I had a company that needed bridge financing, was what we would call it, to get me from where I am today with a plan, with good leadership, with articulate plan to say, here's the problems that I have today. Here's what I need to hold me through so I can fix these problems.
A performance in the past, a plan for the future, and good leadership that can make it happen.
Exactly. Well, the banks are basically prohibited from lending because of the scrutiny that their balance sheets are under today. And yes, they were a lot looser than they should be. But, that's a little bit like kicking the can down the road and hoping that 2 years from now the economy will get better. We need participation in things like that. We need some business people. We need the telecom industry to help us to get high-speed broadband and to understand that it's a pipeline, to understand that, we shouldn't be paying $120 just to connect to the internet. To have cable TV to watch 4,000 channels that we don't watch. But the motivations out there, I mean, the individual company motivations are not there. But let's imagine for a moment that Google Fiber and Apple HomeKit and Cisco routers and a couple other companies were all encouraged, in fact, could put a project together in one of these places and make all of this modern technology come together in a community. There's a little place called Sandy, Oregon, that did it themselves with a municipal bond, I think for $7 million. They're providing high-speed broadband. All of their traffic lights are in sync, and all for $30 to $60 to all of their constituents.
Oh, that's incredible. Yeah, see, those are solutions to problems that we need to do, but it takes people working together and the traits that you're talking about. You have to listen.
Exactly.
And you have to work together because the way the world works, it's too complex for one thing to do it all by themselves.
Exactly. And collaboration is there, encouragement, It's just amazing what can be done. And when we go into a company, the productivity on, for example, this Styrotech, they were losing money. Actually, manufacturing was shut down. They manufacture packaging for the grape produce to be shipped around the world. And they were spilling out 100,000 gallons of water per day in the California drought.
Throwing it away. Oh, geez.
Exactly. So, but I'll tell you what, I came in and because of a farming and agriculture background, I knew some of the water issues could be solved with equipment on a flatbed trailer. So we got that in here and solved that real quickly. But the other people here, we sat down and came up with a couple different plans, put some objectives together. 8 weeks later, we were back up running. And 3 months later, the company was profitable.
Excellent. So those are the things, the solutions that you can do. Sometimes it just takes somebody that, like you said, thinks out of the box and go in, look with a fresh perspective, but also listen.
Exactly.
Well, how can people learn more about you and your company and just see more? Because you have a book out there. You have a website. I can put your information up on my webpage, which is great. But is there any information you want to part with?
Well, that'd be great. I mean, I will respond to inquiries. All of our guys will at Verto Partners, V-E-R-T-O Partners. And my email is richard@vertopartners.com. So I'm very happy to respond to all interested parties.
Well, excellent. Well, thank you so much, Richard. I really appreciate you coming on the show today.
Thank you very much for inviting me, Sarah. I enjoyed it.
Thank you so much for listening to us today on Business Game Changers. I'm Sarah Westall, and I want to remind you, go to my website at sarahwestall.com to hear any of my past shows, including this one. And for now, I hope everyone has a wonderful day.
You've been listening to Business Game Changers with host Sarah Westall. Tune in each Monday at noon Pacific, 3 Eastern, as Sarah brings you leading experts, visionaries, and newsmakers who provide the best commentary on big issues and cutting-edge innovations. Sarah's 20 years as a business executive will help you think like an entrepreneur with expertise, energy, and attitude. Tune in Mondays at 12 noon Pacific time and learn more about Sarah at sarahwestall.com today.